to the fifth case, United States v. Arceo. Mr. DeCastro? Arceo. Mr. DeCastro?
Once again, good morning. May it please the Court, Pablo DeCastro for Mr. Arceo. I will be brief, Your Honor. This appeal is perhaps not as complicated as some of the others that have been before you this morning. It is a constitutional speedy trial issue primarily. Mr. Arceo was originally under investigation in 1999, cooperated with the authorities for a couple of days, and prior to being charged in any formal way, left the jurisdiction. The agents last spoke to him on August 14th of 1999, and no warrant was issued for his arrest until December of 2005. He was not formally charged until at least 2 weeks or 3 weeks after he had been found not to be at his home. It was August 14th or so when they went to his house and didn't find him there, and it wasn't until November that an indictment was filed. After that indictment was filed, essentially nothing further was done to locate him or to try to notify him of the charges. Nevertheless, he has been called a fugitive by the government and by the lower court. He's been labeled a fugitive.
I thought he promised to stay in touch here, which is fairly typical, isn't it? Promised to stay in touch with the agents, and then he disappeared 3 days later and went to Mexico for years and lived under a false name in Pennsylvania. He wasn't fulfilling his part of the bargain.
I agree, Your Honor. A lot of cases were cited, and I won't go through them individually except for the one Doggett. It was very similar. He was under investigation. He knew that he was under investigation. He left. The agents found him present in Colombia and in Panama, were aware of his presence at specific locations, albeit out of the country. And even though he was in those other countries, their failure to bring him back was deemed to be government negligence. In this case, the DEA kept informing the U.S. Attorney's Office that they could not effectively launch a search for this individual without a warrant, and that no warrant had issued mistake.
I think you're right that they should have secured an arrest warrant immediately, but because they didn't, I don't know that that should inure to
the benefit
of somebody who was obviously hiding and didn't want to be.
One way to look at the potential effect of that would be that once the warrant issued, he was apprehended within a few months without any problem. It was not difficult to find him once they issued the warrant. His efforts, whatever they may have been to evade the authorities, were wholly ineffective once the warrant issued. He could have been, and up until that point, as I said in my brief, he could have been standing outside the courthouse door. He could have been walking into the police station every other week and asking, hey, guys, do you got a warrant for me? And they would have said no. The fact that he didn't do that doesn't mean that he's necessarily, or that his hiding contributed to the delay in the case. Even to the extent that his actions contributed to the delay, we feel that the lower court's ruling ignored the contribution of the government's negligence as well. The government's actions or inactions in this case clearly were negligent, and that negligence clearly does contribute to the delay to some degree, and according to the case law from the Supreme Court, it contributes to enough of a degree to weigh that factor in favor of the defendant. In a case like this where there are four factors to weigh and really only two of them matter, there is the reason for the delay, which we're arguing about now, and there is whether or not there was any prejudice. The other factors really don't figure into it in this particular case. There's no dispute that the length of delay was long enough to be presumptively prejudicial and trigger the other factors. The big dispute is about the delay. There's really no dispute about his assertion of his right, because that's generally not something you would expect someone to do until he's been informed of the charges against him and brought before the court. But with respect to prejudice, there's another dispute. Doggett, again, claim that the length of the delay in certain cases can be long enough that actual prejudice need not be shown, that a delay of that such a length would prejudice the proceedings in such a way that neither party could really identify, neither party can really be expected to prove. People lose their memory, witnesses disappear. A delay, once it gets beyond a certain point, creates a situation where actual prejudice doesn't need to be shown. The government has made much of arguing that there wasn't any actual prejudice here, but they've done nothing to distinguish Doggett on that point, nor, for that matter, on the reason for the delay. I reserve the rest of my time, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. DeCastro. Mr. Shakeshaft?
Good morning. May it please the Court, Counsel. I'm Tom Shakeshath. I'm the Assistant United States Attorney here in Chicago on behalf of the government. Counsel is correct that the crux of this case is the reason for the delay. And the record is clear in this case that the reason for the delay in apprehending the defendant, the largest single factor, is that the defendant intentionally fled the jurisdiction. The facts of this case are pretty simple, and it's a typical scenario. The defendant was arrested in August of 1999 with 5 kilograms of cocaine in his front seat. He agreed to cooperate with the DEA, and in fact did cooperate for a period of 2 days, and his cooperation did in fact lead to the apprehension and ultimate prosecution of 2 co-defendants. 2 days later, the defendant was told to stay in touch with DEA to continue his contribution or to continue his cooperation. 2 days later, he left the jurisdiction, and the evidence is clear that he left the jurisdiction and went to Mexico for a period of 3 years, only to return to the United States under an assumed name for an additional 4 years. When the defendant was ultimately apprehended in Pennsylvania in 2006, at a detention hearing there, the defendant's wife testified and testified to all of those facts. And I would bring the Court's attention to the appendix, pages 22 through 24, where Maria Arceo made a number of important concessions. Those were that the defendant intentionally went to Mexico to avoid what she described as the problems in Chicago, and that he lived in Mexico for 3 years. And when he returned to the United States, she admitted that he returned here under an assumed name because he could not return under his own names, again, because of the problems in Chicago. And so, on the one side of the scale of the reasons for the delay, you have a defendant who intentionally, for the entirety of the period of absence here, intended to evade law enforcement, to delay the prosecution in this case. On the other side, the counsel has noted that there were a couple of problems on the other side. There was a clerical error. The record shows that when the indictment came down in this case in November of 1999, the magistrate who took the indictment ordered that a warrant be issued, and one was not. So I would label that a mistake. And the DEA did ask that that a warrant be issued, and it is clear from the record that perhaps the U.S. Attorney's Office could have been more diligent. But the Supreme Court in Doggett and in Parker and in Doggett and in this Court's cases has indicated that the second step, it's a comparative analysis of the reason for the delay. And on this in this case, you have, through the entirety of the delay, the defendant's intentional conduct, and on the other side, really nothing, a clerical mistake, and then the failure to issue the warrant. And counsel argues that the defendant could have walked in and said that, you know, do you have a warrant for me? It is important that the defendant did not walk in and ask, did you have a warrant for me? And in counsel's brief, there's an argument that somehow or another it seems that the defendant didn't know about the outstanding these charges that would be filed against him, and that differentiates this case from Doggett. This case is different from Doggett. The facts of Doggett show that the defendant was living in the open. In that case, Doggett's wife testified that there was no evidence that he did know about the charges here. In this case, Mrs. Arceo testified that the entirety of the defendant's conduct was related to his knowledge of the charges in this case. The agent testified he was told that he was going to be charged, and he left because he was going to be charged. So the four-part analysis in this case all cut against, with the exception of the presumptive prejudice, all cut against the defendant. And for that reason, Your Honors, we would request that the district court's finding that there was no violation of the defendant's speedy trial rights be affirmed. The defendant has made 2 additional arguments that I'll touch on very briefly.
Let me ask, how was he found in Pennsylvania? Was that a routine traffic stop or?
No, the U.S., once the warrant was issued, the marshals did start an investigation. They were able to track the defendant through his wife's driver's license, which ultimately came back to an address in Pennsylvania. So over a course of 4 or 5 months, they were ultimately able to track him down. So it was the marshals doing a routine investigation of a fugitive.
Mr. Shakespeare, when did the DEA agents start their attempts to determine whether a warrant had been?
There are a number of DEA sixes. It appears that they engage in their usual either 6 months to a year review of fugitive cases. So pretty shortly, within a matter of months, they recognized that a warrant had not been issued. And the sixes are clear that they brought it to the U.S. Attorney's Office and did so periodically, usually 6 months to a year, through the early 2000 period.
Does the record reflect, let's assume that, the record seems to indicate, that he was told he would be charged later, not whether or not he would be charged at all, right? That's your position?
That's correct. The record shows the agent clearly told him he would be charged, but did not tell him when.
Right. And does the record indicate when the DEA then sought further contact with him?
Within a matter of days. The testimony was that the agent, it was a two-day period where he cooperated. The agent told him that he was not being taken into custody, but that he was to stay in telephonic contact. And within a day or two, the agents tried to contact him on his cell phone, and he was nowhere to be found. They then went out to his residence because they'd searched it on the day of the arrest and found that it appeared he had moved out. And they, in fact, talked to the building manager and said that apartment was now empty. So certainly within a matter of a week, but I think it was within a matter of 2 or 3 days, Your Honor. With regard to the other two arguments, the obstruction of justice argument, I think, is pretty well laid out in the brief. The defendant clearly did willfully flee to avoid prosecution, and consequently the two-point enhancement does apply, and Judge Kaur did give the defendant a break for his cooperation in this case and posed a low-end guideline sentence, which we would submit was reasonable. If the court has no further questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. Mr. DeCastro.
Your Honor, if I may, counsel cites a couple of clerical errors, mistakes, indicates that the U.S. Attorney's Office could have been more diligent. These are all phrases and words that kind of dance around the word negligence. These are negligent. That is what constitutes government negligence, that it was brought to their attention, somebody didn't do anything. That's exactly the sort of thing that happened in Doggett. They knew where he was. They initiated proceedings to extradite and never followed up. It's the absence of, or the lack of action in a specified course when courts have determined there was an affirmative duty. Courts have repeatedly held there's an affirmative duty for the government to track down people and inform them of charges pending against them. And it goes beyond knocking on his door, realizing he's not there, and throwing up your hands and walking away for 6 years. Now, the DEA didn't do that. The DEA tried to do more. They needed the help of the U.S. Attorney's Office, who didn't give it. Further, I wanted to address something the court brought up, that apparently that the agent had testified that he had been informed, that he had informed the defendant he would be charged. He did say that on direct examination, but I bring the court's attention to the... is it my fault? I'm sorry. That on cross-examination, after the agent gets off of the questions he's already prepared for, and he gets a question he wasn't prepared for, he says, well, no, I honestly don't remember if I told him. Well, when did you tell him? I don't know if I did. Did you tell him when he was going to be charged? No, I don't know. As of the 14th, or the 13th, which was the last day you saw him, as of that day, had he been told? I don't remember.
But he did tell him he would be charged. I understand you're making the point about when, but...
But he said that on direct, and when he was asked again on cross, he went back on it. He said, no, I don't remember, honestly. So our position is, you know, as any trial lawyer...
Is he not remembering, Mr. DeCastro?
Cross-examination.
Whether...
Right.
Is it the timing or the fact of whether or not he would... or direction that he would be charged?
I believe we cited and quoted two specific questions that addressed those two separate questions. One was, Did you tell him when he would be charged? And he said no. The other was, as of the 14th, did you tell him that he would be charged? And he said, I don't remember. And he didn't say, no, we didn't tell him. He said, I don't remember, which is directly contradicting what he said on direct. And once again, like I, as I said, any trial lawyer will tell you that he, on direct examination, he's answering questions he's ready for. And on cross, maybe not. So which one would you look to for the truth? As to counsel's statements about the obstruction aspect of the case, I just want to say one thing. Most of the cases that were cited by myself as well as by the government can be distinguished. The reason we cited the Stites case from the Ninth Circuit, even though it's from the Ninth Circuit, is that we believe, factually speaking, it is the closest comparison to what happened here. Mr. Stites also left the jurisdiction for a time under similar circumstances. Another case that was similar here in this circuit was White. There were two different cases named White that were cited. This is the one found at 903 F. 2nd 457, where this court looked at a person who had left the jurisdiction under similar circumstances and basically said it would not have been obstruction except for a couple of things, that he engaged in some high-speed chase through crowded areas and endangered the public. But if not for that, I believe this court would have found that there was no obstruction, simply leaving the jurisdiction and keeping one's head in the sand. So with that, Your Honor, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Castro. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.